Good morning. Welcome to Asia Today with Jeffrey Bingham Mead. I'm so glad that you could join us today. We're coming to you and the world with the miracle of modern technology and the magic of 21st century broadcasting from the renowned studios of Radio 1490 WGCH Greenwich, Connecticut, USA, and WGCH.com anywhere via live streaming over the internet. Our goal is to contribute to global understanding, promote connections in the arts, culture, education, business, public policy, and international exchange, and create opportunities in the spirit of enduring exploration, friendship, and trust, with a focus on the Asia-Pacific region. We've got a great show for you, so without further delay, let's get started.
Coming up on today's show,
my returning guest will be author James M. Scott, a former Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. James M. Scott is the author of Rampage, MacArthur, Yamashita, and the Battle of Manila. Rampage was named one of the best books of 2018 by the editors at Amazon, Kirkus, and Military Times, and was chosen as a finalist for the prestigious Gilder Lehrman Prize for Military History by the New York Historical Society. The New York Journal of Books calls Rampage a horrifyingly unforgettable book, reminds us once again that man's inhumanity to man bellies the notion of human progress. The massacres in Manila that Scott so painstakingly details take their place among the 20th century's most monstrous and lurid crimes.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after these important messages.
Hello, everyone. This is Jeffrey Bingham Mead on Radio 1490 WGCH, Greenwich, Connecticut, USA, and FM 105.5 FM and WGCH.com anywhere live streaming on the internet. Did you know that frequent hand washing is one of the best ways to avoid getting sick and spreading illness? When you touch people, surfaces, and objects throughout the day, you accumulate germs on your hands. You can infect yourself with these germs by touching your eyes, nose, or mouth, or spread them to others. Washing your hands frequently can help limit the transfer of bacteria, viruses, and other microbes. It's generally best to wash your hands with soap and water. Over-the-counter antibacterial soaps are no more effective at killing germs than is regular soap. Wet your hands with clean running water, either warm or cold. Then apply and lather well. Rub your hands vigorously for at least 20 seconds. Remember to scrub all surfaces, including the backs of your hands, wrists, between your fingers, and under your fingernails. Rinse well. Dry your hands with a clean towel or air dry them. Frequent hand washing offers great rewards in terms of preventing illness. Adopting this habit can play a major role in protecting your health and the health of others. Learn more at cdc.gov, the official website of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Thank you.
Welcome to Conversations with Jeffrey Bingham Mead, your host.
Before World War II, Manila was a slice of America in Asia, populated with elegant neoclassical buildings, spacious parks, and home to thousands of U.S. servicemen and business executives who enjoyed the relaxed pace of the tropics. The outbreak of World War II, however, brought an end to the good life. General Douglas MacArthur, hoping to protect the Pearl of the Orient, declared the Philippine capital an open city and evacuated his forces. The Japanese seized Manila on January 2, 1942, rounding up an internment. Thousands of Americans. MacArthur vowed to return, and he did in 1945. Determined to fight to the death, Japanese forces barricaded intersections, converted buildings into fortresses, booby-trapped stores, graveyards, and even dead bodies. The 29-day battle to liberate Manila resulted in the catastrophic destruction of the city and a rampage by Japanese forces that brutalized the civilian population. More died here than in the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. Based on extensive research in the United States and the Philippines, including war crimes testimony, after-action reports, and survivor interviews, Rampage, MacArthur, Yamashita, and the Battle of Manila
recounts one of the most heartbreaking chapters of the Pacific War history. And with me today is the author of this remarkable book. He's with us by phone, James M. Scott. Welcome back to the show. Atea, James, we recently featured an encore broadcast of our conversation way back when about Target Tokyo and the Doolittle Raid. And you have really outdone yourself this time. So for this and I know there's more to come. So with our new audience members, I would like to know if you would just bring us up to speed. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Great. Well, Jeffrey, thanks so much for having me on again and for the support with the Doolittle book and now with Rampage as well. So it's both of these are stories very near and dear to my heart. So I write about World War II, specifically in the Pacific. I've written about the submarine war, America's submarine blockade against Japan in my book, The War Below, the April 1942 Doolittle Raid in my book, Target Tokyo, and now the Battle of Manila and the destruction there to the former Pearl of the Orient and Rampage. And I'm currently working on a new book now on Curtis LeMay and the B-29 campaign against Japan, specifically focusing on the March 1945 firebombing of Tokyo, which was the single most destructive air raid of World War II history.
Oh, my God.
Killed 104,000 people in one night. It was a real big moral turning point for the United States, a real shift in our strategy and our tactics.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of burrowing in on that story at the moment.
My goodness. Wow.
I pick all the upbeat stories, as my editor said.
Well, yes, in your own way, you sure do. Now, I want to know if you would spend a couple of moments setting the stage for our listeners. Now, Manila, you know, I live in Hawaii most of the year, but so I know a lot of people from Philippines. And Manila was known back in those days as the Pearl of the Orient. Share with us what Manila was like before the outbreak of the war in December 1941.
Absolutely. It really was just a pretty magical place. You know, the United States had captured the Philippines during the Spanish-American War. And unlike Cuba, which we granted independence, we decided to hang on to the Philippines. And the reason being is we recognize its great strategic value there in the Pacific. But also, we really wanted to use it as a hub for American businesses. And we recognized that it needed a facelift at that time. It had been under Spanish rule for more than three centuries. And so we brought in Daniel Burnham, who was the famed municipal planner and architect who, over the course of his career, had helped cities like Chicago. He's the one who came up with Lakeshore Drive.
Mm.
He'd helped San Francisco. He built designed the Union Station in Washington, which is the great transit hub there at Capitol Hill, which is still in use today.
Yeah.
And, of course, New York's famous Flatiron Building. And so he went over and spent 6 weeks in the Philippines, and his goal was to sort of design a municipal plan for Manila. And it was a pretty magical plan filled with parks. In fact, he has a huge bayfront parkway there, which he later parroted in Chicago with Lakeshore Drive. So it was a city, he came up with the ideas for sort of how to do the parks, how to do the architecture, the design and whatnot. And over the course of the next four decades, a lot of that plan really began to materialize. You saw it in the construction of a lot of neoclassical government buildings, you know, the legislature, the post office, the city hall. The Manila Hotel was it's still there today. It's a magnificent hotel right there on the water, built in 1911, which was sort of ground zero for the American expatriate life. And, of course, the Philippine General Hospital was another one. So, you know, during that time period, it really, you know, you saw sort of the rise of this great city. And then at the same time, you know, we had a lot of American service members stationed over there. And then, of course, business executives, their families, who were doing a lot of work, not only in the Philippines, but also, you know, traveling around China, India, Malaysia, and places like that. And so it really developed this pretty thriving expatriate community. And, you know, people were really drawn to it. It was a great relaxed pace of life compared to New York or Washington. And the dollar went a whole lot farther there.
Oh, yeah.
So, but it really was all accounts of it, you know, that I've read from the diaries and the letters and interviews, it really was just a pretty awesome place to be before World War II.
Sure. Now, one of the things that I found fascinating about Rampage, your book, was that you provide both civilian and military stories, and it's kind of an unusual thing. I think it's fabulous. It's a mix that I think elevates the authenticity of your narrative. So was that on purpose? And if so, just explain to us.
Yeah, no, it was on purpose. And the reason being is, I mean, the Battle of Manila really is a civilian story. I mean, you know, 100,000 people were killed there. you know, literally 100 civilians died for every one U.S. soldier. And this was the only urban battle of the Pacific War that Americans fought in. And so we, and so here on this battlefield was literally, you know, hotels and hotel rooms and people's houses and schools. I mean, one of the battles took place in the baseball stadium and the dugouts. I mean, it really, and of course, trapped on this battlefield were all these civilians who were not only many of them killed during, you know, artillery and things like that, but also through the wanton destruction of the Japanese as well. And so I really wanted to capture that. And even beyond that, I really wanted to capture the experience of what it was like for the Americans. So I sort of profiled sort of three prominent Americans throughout the story who were, you know, internees that, you know, they've been there throughout the war in the Santo Tomas internment camp, but also sort of center the story around three Filipino families who were outside the camp and sort of right in the middle of the battlefield to kind of between the, that gives you kind of the American civilian and the Filipino civilian story. Sure. In addition to the military story.
Yeah. Now, I have to tell, I found your portrait of General Douglas MacArthur absolutely fascinating. I learned more about him on your book than anywhere. And so tell us a little bit about him and this special relationship that he had with the Philippines.
Absolutely. Well, the challenge with MacArthur is how to fit all of that information into the shortest amount of space, because he really, between MacArthur and his family, I mean, they bookend everything from the Civil War all the way up into the through the Korean War, which is a pretty amazing feat. But MacArthur really is, and he and his family had a huge ties to the Philippines. I mean, his father actually had helped capture Manila during the Spanish-American War, served as one of the early military governors there. Douglas MacArthur, during his own career, had served multiple times in the Philippines, including his first assignment right out of West Point in 1903, all the way up to leading the entire American military garrison there. And then, of course, when he retires in 1935, he accepts an offer from the Philippines, who at that point are on track for independence in 1946, to come over and help build their army to prepare them for independence. And so he comes back over in 1935, and he's there all the way up until the war breaks out. One of the fascinating things for MacArthur, too, is that, you know, his whole life, he's the son of a military officer, so he's bounced all around, you know, from different bases growing up around America and then overseas. Manila, really, for MacArthur, was the one place he really felt at home. It was his equivalent of a hometown. In fact, he once said, you know, Manila is where, you know, his mother had died, his wife had been courted, and his son had been born. And it really was the one place later in life, right before the war broke out, when he was happiest. You know, he was there. He was out from under the shadow of his mother and his father, who at this point had passed away. He'd met his wife. He'd been married. He had a son. He had this great, you know, this relaxed pace of life in this wonderful city. And really, for the first time, he wasn't lonely. He wasn't sad. You know, he wasn't under those pressures and whatnot. And then, of course, World War II breaks out, and the Japanese come, and they take all of that away from him. And so that, I think, really builds into the power of his statement when he finally escapes the Philippines and he reaches Australia, and he vows, "I shall return." For MacArthur, it's not so much a, "I'm going to just go back and sort of avenge this defeat." For MacArthur, it's he left his home there. You know, he left all of his worldly belongings in his home there. I mean, he left his father's Civil War medals. He left his son's baby book. He left his wife's jewelry. I mean, when they evacuated, they left everything, including, of course, the one place in life he'd really felt happy. And I think that's all built into that famous, that iconic phrase of World War II.
Now, how did the Filipinos respond to the collapse of the U.S. military and its abandonment of the islands to the Imperial Japanese forces?
Well, you know, the tragedy is, of course, when the Americans do, you know, the Americans are, MacArthur declares Manila an open city, which it means, for folks who aren't familiar with the military, that he's taking it off the battlefield. He's moving all of his troops outside the city, and he's trying to protect this wonderful city. And so he takes his troops, and they go to the Bataan Peninsula and to the fortified island of Corregidor, where they valiantly hold out. They don't have the reinforcements they need. They don't have the food supplies. They don't have hardly anything yet. They hold out on Bataan until April and then on Corregidor until May. And it's truly just a remarkable, heroic stand by American and Filipino soldiers. But, of course, in the end, they're doomed. You know, they're out of food and everything, and it collapses. And so begins the Japanese occupation of the Philippines, which is a very dark period in Filipino history, and it's one that a lot of readers don't, at least American readers, don't know that much about, because during those 3 years, you really see the unraveling of the economics of the Philippines and largely of their social fabric. Because now the Americans who are left behind, are the soldiers are all marched off to on the Bataan Death March and then placed in prison camps and eventually hell ships. And the American civilians who are left behind, about 7,000 of them, are all rounded up and put in internment camps. And so the Americans all suffer in prisoner war camps, internment camps. And the Filipino civilians then suffer under the Japanese occupation, which was a totally mismanaged shot by the Japanese, who essentially wrecked their economy. They leave the fields to rot. They steal the farm equipment, ship it back to Japan and whatnot. So that as 1942 rolls into 43, 44, and 45, you start seeing, widespread starvation. About 500 people a day are starving to death in Manila. An army of beggars literally flood the streets. People get so desperate to survive that they actually begin selling their own children.
To
abandoning them to orphanages or selling them. They start robbing graves that they can take eyeglasses, dentures, clothing off of corpses, anything that could be bartered or sold. Their economy really breaks down into a bartering system.
Yeah.
And it's just a truly desperate time, all of which, of course, then sets the stage for MacArthur's return in February 1945 in this just, horrific Battle of Manila.
Sure. My friends, we are going to take a short break. You're listening to Conversations on Asia Today with Jeffrey Bingham Mead on Radio 1490 WGCH, Greenwich, Connecticut, USA, 105.5 FM, Stamford, and WGCH.com, anywhere streaming globally via the Internet. My guest today is James M. Scott, the author of Rampage, MacArthur, Yamashita, and the Battle of Manila, which was named one of the best books of 2018 by Amazon and Military Times, and was chosen as a finalist for the prestigious Gilder Lehrman Prize for Military History by the New York Historical Society. I urge you please to purchase your copy through Amazon or your preferred bookseller. We will be right back. The Pacific Learning Consortium is synonymous with the pursuit of long-lasting cross-cultural relationships with an eye for excellence. It's committed to developing intercultural and international relationships between people and organizations, making it a leader in bringing people and ideas together, too. The Pacific Learning Consortium's mission is to help engage diverse communities, shape trusting relationships through friendship, constructive collaboration, while investing its talents and energies in the success of every client and every enterprise. In an increasingly globally connected world pivoting to the Indo-Pacific Asia region, you need a partner that you can trust. The Pacific Learning Consortium focuses on delivering customized services, connecting and nurturing our clients in the fields of education, media, civic affairs, and business. You're invited to explore how an alliance with the Pacific Learning Consortium can help you. Learn more at pacificlearningconsortium.org, call 808-721-0306, or email pacificlearningconsortium@gmail.com. Welcome back. My guest today is James M. Scott, the author of Rampage, MacArthur, Yamashita, and the Battle of Manila. It is a definitive history of one of the most brutal campaigns of the war in the Pacific. James, thank you very much for staying with us through the break. This is an incredible story that you have written, so we thank you for it.
Thank you.
I have to ask you. You have another very interesting soul here that fascinated me, and his name is Japanese, of course. His name is General Yamashita. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he's a really fascinating character as well. He's also known as the Tiger of Malaya, and General Yamashita, of course, and that nickname comes from his early success in World War II, in which he defeated the British and was able to take Singapore from them in just a matter of weeks. And so he's really one of Japan's top generals, but his rivalry with War Minister Hideki Tojo and really Tojo's jealousy of him and after his success in Singapore leads Tojo to send him off to Manchuria for much of the rest of the war, really park him on the sidelines, if you will, of the conflict. And it's only in 1944, after Japan's fortunes are deteriorating and the Americans take the Mariana Islands and are setting the stage for the big bombing raids of the homeland, that Tojo gets fired as a result of that. And with Tojo's ouster comes Yamashita's resurrection. And he is then sent to the Philippines to make a last stand and try to block MacArthur, who at this point is really driving his way north to the Japanese mainland. You know, he escapes to Australia, he goes across New Guinea, and he's sort of making his way there. And Yamashita's job is to essentially bog him down, slow him down, and give the Japanese mainland time to prepare for the end of the war, and for this climactic battle. And so he's a real fascinating character. In that, you know, he's this great soldier, much like MacArthur.
Yeah.
And, you know, here the two of them are about to square off in the Philippines.
Indeed. Now, I wanted to know if you would just share with us what life was like during the Japanese occupation of Manila.
Yeah, and the Japanese occupation for the Filipinos was a really brutal time period. I mean, they, you know, as their economy had collapsed and the you know, the basic goods had vanished. I mean, people really, you know, you couldn't get things like medicines. You couldn't get things like cigarettes. You know, the really day-to-day survival became more and more brutal and more difficult as the war progressed, to the point that by the end of 1944, literally 500 people a day were dying of starvation there. So it really was a brutal time for the men, women, and children there in the Philippines. And you know, and they were waiting and praying for the Americans to return and to liberate them. So for the Japanese, I mean, for the Filipinos, the Japanese occupation is a very dark period in their history.
Yeah.
It's one that people were focused literally just on survival.
Yep. Now, MacArthur vowed to return, as you said, and boy, he sure did in 1945. And so the battle to retake Manila was, it really was, according to your book, was like nothing else except perhaps along the lines of the rape of Nanjing in China. You mentioned that. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, MacArthur had come into the city convinced that the Japanese were going to do a lot like he did and declared an open city and leave, because there really wasn't much of a strategic value in Manila other than its waterfront and its anchorage for a navy there. But the Japanese had other plans. And so instead of evacuate, they had a commander by the name of Sanji Iwabuchi, who was in charge of the Manila Naval Defense Force, who really decided he was going to turn Manila into another Stalingrad, that it was going to be a bloodletting, an urban siege, and he was going to try to do everything he could to slow down and hold up the Americans. And that plan included turning the civilians into, you know, who were stuck on the battlefield, really into, you know, targets. And so what they did is, you know, they literally, they went through neighborhoods and set them on fire. They locked civilians in their homes. Before they did that, they, you know, sexually assaulted hundreds of women. I mean, it really was just a portrait of brutality against the Filipino civilians. It's really one of the worst stories of it too. Was this one house on Singalong Street in which the Japanese had gone up to the second floor of this home and they had cut a hole in the floor of it. And then they went through the neighborhood around there, and they rounded up about 400 men. And 200 of them they let off and shot and bayoneted in a field. And the other 200, they marched into this house, brought them up these stairs blindfolded, and forced them to kneel over this hole. And then they decapitated them with a sword.
Yeah.
And then the head and the body would then fall through the hole until they literally filled up this room underneath them with bodies.
Thank God.
And what's amazing is that nine of the men that they did this to survived, because cutting a person's head off with a sword is a lot of work. And if you don't, if you hit it low on the shoulder and on the neck, you get it stuck in that muscle. And that's essentially what they did. And so nine men survived in order to recount what had happened there.
Wow.
And so that's how through their survival and, of course, through war crimes investigators afterwards counting all the skulls that were found on this property, we know exactly what happened inside that home. So that's, it gives you an example sort of the barbarity that took place during those 29 days.
After the war's end, Yamashita was tried and executed in February 1946. And it was interesting. It sparked controversy. And so and it still does today. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, it was. He, you know, Yamashita was, he wasn't actually in Manila during the Battle of Manila. He'd left the city and gone up into the mountains near Baguio. And so he was not there. And so he tried to argue that Admiral Sanji Iwabuchi, who was there, that he was sort of this rogue admiral and that he was the one that was responsible and that he personally would not have done that had he been there. And so he was put, and that was sort of he was put on trial in what today is the American Embassy there. In fact, it's the ballroom there, and you can go visit it. It's a fascinating room to go visit. And his trial stretched over 32 days. They brought in over 200 witnesses to testify against him. These were survivors of the brutality of the Japanese forces. They were grave diggers. They were teachers. They were parents. They were children. And so he was tried before a panel of five military judges, and in the end, he was found guilty. And, you know, the argument that the prosecutors made was, you know, the idea that you may not have known about this, really, that might explain what happened in Manila, but the reality was these kinds of atrocities took place all over the Philippines. Yeah. And so the rogue admiral defense really didn't work. I mean, in fact, American investigators tallied that there were 27 major atrocities that took place in Manila during the battle, but they ultimately tallied about 300 major atrocities that took place throughout the islands. So, you know, you can't, you know, as the commander of all the military forces in the Philippines, you know, essentially all those people were under your control and under, you know, the civilians should have been protected since they're non-combatants.
Sure.
So his argument just didn't hold up in court at that time, and he was found guilty.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But his case was appealed all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And there he eventually lost, and he was hanged in early 1946 in the Philippines.
What, as we start to conclude, what is the legacy of the Battle of Manila in the Philippines today, and why should this be better known to Americans as well? It shocks me, you know, after reading your book that it isn't. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's a big legacy. In fact, you know, last year, you know, the book came out in the Philippines, and it was, knock on wood, it was a big success over there. I went over there and did a whole book tour. There remains significant interest in the Battle of Manila. In fact, we were expecting about 100 people to show up at the book launch in the Philippines. We had 300 people turn out.
Wow.
I met more Battle of Manila survivors. I mean, people came out. One woman brought me her diary. You know, another woman showed me her shrapnel scars from the battle. I mean, this was still, you know, because the Battle of Manila, it didn't affect just sort of the military-aged male of that time period. You know, it affected all generations of Filipino life. It affected children who survived it, who may have lost their parents or their grandparents. It affected the middle-aged people who may have lost children or their parents. And, of course, it affected the elderly. So it really tore a big gaping wound in the family structure of the Philippines. And as a result of that, it's still carried on today. I mean, I have a friend of mine whose family survived it. He said, you know, there wasn't a Sunday that dinner that didn't pass, that somebody didn't make mention of what had happened during the Battle of Manila.
Right, right.
And so, you know, in the late 1990s, a group of Battle of Manila survivors formed an organization called the Memorare Manila 1945 Foundation. And they have really worked over the years, too, to make sure that school children have the resources and materials to put on symposiums and speakers and things like that, to also really make sure that it's remembered. And, of course, Battle of Manila, the scars of the battle are still there.
Yeah.
You go to the U.S. Embassy there, and the shrapnel is still on the flagpole. You go to Santo Tomas, which is a big internment camp, there's still shrapnel marks in the doors there.
Sure.
So there's still, you know, the city itself still bears the physical scars of this battle.
Yeah, yeah. Guest today has been James M. Scott. He's the author of Rampage, MacArthur, Yamashita, and the Battle of Manila, which was named one of the best books of 2018 by Amazon and Military Times, and it was chosen as a finalist for the prestigious Gilder Lehrman Prize for Military History by the New York Historical Society. James, I got to tell you, I've outdone yourself this time, and I want to thank you for being with us, especially in these chaotic times that we are putting up with today, and you are welcome to your anytime.
Jeffrey, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure and an honor to come on your show and talk to you and your listeners. Thank you for having me.
As we like to say at my home in Hawaii, ahoi ho kakou, until we meet again. We'll be back next Saturday morning starting 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. See you then.